This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Depression is our topic this afternoon. Our guest is writer Andrew Solomon, author of The Noonday Demon, an Atlas of Depression. Andrew Solomon knows firsthand the debilitations of depression. He has suffered and survived three breakdowns. Visiting a wood where he and his brother once played beneath a 100-year-old oak, he finds a vine has attached itself to the tree and is all but smothering it. Depression, he says, is like being a tree strangled by a vine. This is from The Noonday Demon. I empathized with that tree. My depression had grown on me as that vine had conquered the oak. It had been a sucking thing that had wrapped itself around me, ugly and more alive than I. It had had a life of its own that bit by bit asphyxiated all of my life out of me. At the worst stage of major depression, I had moods that I knew were not my moods. They belonged to the depression, as surely as the leaves on that tree's high branches belonged to the vine. The Noonday Demon has taken me, Celeste Quinn, alongside this sickness. I'm learning how depression affects people. No two depressions are the same. I'm learning how depression affects various demographic groups. I'm learning about treatments. I empathize with those stricken, and I am buoyed by their courage. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments about depression this afternoon for our guest, Andrew Solomon. You can join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Andrew Solomon is a regular contributor to the New Yorker Art Forum and the New York Times Magazine. He is the author of The Ivory Tower, Soviet Artists in a Time of Glasnost, and the novel A Stone Boat, which was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times First Fiction Award. The Noonday Demon, an Atlas of Depression, is published by Scribner. Andrew Solomon, good afternoon. Welcome.
What a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk with you. This is a beautiful book.
Thank you very much.
There are many moving stories in this book. One involves a survivor of the Khmer Rouge regime. Would you please tell us about the woman who, after suffering all kind of horror, has set up an orphanage and a center for depressed women in Cambodia?
Yes, she was a really extraordinary woman, and I was very, very moved by her story, which I really stumbled on through happenstance. Her name is Thali Nguyen, and she's a sort of physically small, diminutive Cambodian woman who I met when I was in Cambodia doing research on some other topics. And she herself went through many terrible things during that period of the Pol Pot regime. She was taken from Phnom Penh, where she had been working as a secretary in the Institute of Finance. She had to pretend to be illiterate because everyone who knew how to read or write was being killed by the regime. She was taken by a group of soldiers to a re-education camp with her three children, a daughter who was 12, a son who was 6, and an infant son. On the way to the re-education camp, she was forced to watch. She was tied to a tree and forced to watch while the soldiers gang-raped and then murdered her daughter. She then got to the re-education camp with the two sons, where she was put to hard physical labor in the fields. And after about 6 months, she was to be sent off to the killing fields. And when she got there, she was tied to a stick and put over a ravine in such a way that when she let go of the tension in her leg, she would fall headlong into the ravine and told bullets were too good for the likes of her. She had persuaded one of the soldiers there that she had actually been the mistress of someone in the Khmer Rouge, and on the basis of that lie, the soldier let her go, and he said, "I don't know if I really believe you or not." He said, "You can run into the jungle, but if any of us see you again, we'll kill you." And so she ran through the jungle, living on whatever she could find there. She was malnourished, and her breast milk dried up, and so her infant died as well. And she and the one son she had left managed to live for more than 2 years in the jungle. She said, never sleeping in the same place twice. And after she had been through all of these atrocities, when the war actually ended, she was placed in a camp for displaced persons. And when she was there, she saw that there were many women there who had survived the difficulties and the horrors of the war, who were just lying on the ground and not taking care of their own children and not taking care of themselves and wasting away. And she said, I felt I had to do something for these poor women and to help them in some way. She said, bit by bit, I understood that their problem was that they were terribly depressed, and I came up with a 3-point program. She said, first, I would go and talk to them, and I would just chatter with them, and I would fill their heads with anything, often with nonsense, but just so I could take up some room in their heads so I could help them to forget, so there would be something in their minds besides the terrible, terrible things that were playing there over and over again that they would never be able entirely to put behind them. And when I felt I had taught them to begin to forget, then I would teach them to work. Many of them would never be able to do more than to clean a house, but at least I would teach them to do that much so they would have something they could do that they would claim as their own. And when I had taught them to forget and to work, then I would teach them to do manicures and pedicures. And I said, I beg your pardon. And she said, I would found that what happened in the Khmer Rouge period was that half of this country had risen up against the other half of the country. And what people had really lost was the ability to trust anyone or to be intimate with anyone. And doing manicures and pedicures is a very physical thing, and it puts people in very close contact with one another, but without transgressing any physical or sexual boundaries. And all of these women really wanted to be beautiful, and it made them quite lightheaded and a little giggly and giddy to be doing this thing that was all about looking nice. And as they did this thing with each other, they were in such close contact with each other, and they were touching each other's bodies and doing things to each other's bodies, and they began talking to each other about different things, sometimes little things, sometimes the things that had happened to them. And bit by bit, they began to connect to other people again, and they began to do the very beginning of what constituted friendships. They began to trust other people. She said, so that was my program. And when I had taught them to forget and to work and to trust, then I tried to teach them that those are not three separate skills, but three parts of a single idea. And when they understood that, I felt they were ready to go into the world again. Mm. And what she did ultimately was to have all of these women who had recovered to some degree from their depression through that program, many of whom wanted to continue to be with her, go to work in the orphanage she set up for children who had been orphaned during the Khmer Rouge period. And she still has the treatment program for depressed women, though now that she's better funded, in times of change, she also uses antidepressant medication, and the women who worked with her continue to staff the orphanage. She was a remarkable woman, and what was most striking to me was that she was someone who had no resources and no education as a therapist, but who understood, really, I think, many of the basic principles that are in the talking therapies that have been developed over long periods of time by therapists in the West, which are really that you have to give people an internal structure for themselves, that you have to separate them from the illness that they're experiencing, and that you have to give them the ability to reconnect with other people and a structure within which to do that.
Yeah. Her story is very instructive. And then to follow up at the end of this chapter, this chapter in the book where you tell her story, you reflect on her experience and this trinity of recovery, this trinity of skills, all three elements part of a whole. Do you have the book there with you, Andrew?
Yes, I do.
Would you please read the last two paragraphs of that chapter, page 38?
Page 38. Biology is not destiny. There are ways to lead a good life with depression. Indeed, people who learn from their depression can develop a particular moral profundity from the experience. And this is the thing with feathers at the bottom of their box of miseries. There is a basic emotional spectrum from which we cannot and should not escape. And I believe that depression is in that spectrum, located near not only grief, but also love. Indeed, I believe that all the strong emotions stand together, and that every one of them is contingent on what we commonly think of as its opposite. I have, for the moment, managed to contain the disablement that depression causes, but the depression itself lives forever in the cipher of my brain. It is part of me. To wage war on depression is to fight against oneself, and it is important to know that in advance of the battles, I believe that depression can be eliminated only by undermining the emotional mechanisms that make us human. Science and philosophy must proceed by half measures. Welcome this pain, Ovid once wrote, for you will learn from it. It is possible, though for the time being unlikely, that through chemical manipulation, we might locate, control, and eliminate the brain circuitry of suffering. I hope we will never do it. To take it away would be to flatten out experience, to impinge on a complexity more valuable than any of its component parts are agonizing. If I could see the world in nine dimensions, I'd pay a high price to do it. I would live forever in the haze of sorrow rather than give up on the capacity for pain. But pain is not acute depression. One loves and is loved in great pain, and one is alive in the experience of it. It is the walking death quality of depression that I have tried to eliminate from my life, and it is as artillery against that extinction that this book is written.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Solomon, reading from The Noonday Demon, an Atlas of Depression. Where are we on the course of, as you put it, eliminating the walking death quality of depression?
Well, I think we've made enormous strides over the last, over the last centuries, but particularly over the last 15 years. I think that we don't have a cure for depression, but we have increasingly good treatments for depression, and we are able more and more for a larger and larger part of the population to get people out of that feeling of nullity, that feeling of terrible deadness, that can so readily take over the lives of people who are experiencing severe depression. So that's certainly a great leap forward. I think what we are able to do is also to lift from people that sensation, which is an essential part of the experience of major depression, of everything being just so effortful and so difficult, that feeling that depressed people have that simply getting up and getting dressed and leaving the room is just miserably, impossibly effortful. Medications have helped to control that. More sophistication about talking therapies has helped to control that. And the advent of dozens and dozens of alternative therapies of one kind and another has made an enormous, enormous, terrific difference. And I try to catalog what some of those therapies mm-hmm. are in the book. But I think that people still enter into severe depression, and that we don't know to try the treatments until we've sunk pretty far deep into the problem itself. And certainly there are some people for whom the treatments don't work, and there are some people who have a lifetime pattern of cycling in and out of depression. I think there's still a lot of it out there. I was amazed as I began doing the work on promoting this book and going around and doing readings by how every place that I went, people would come up to me and they would say, I had terrible depression, or my sister had terrible depression, or, oh my God, my best friend has just been going through this. I didn't meet anyone it hadn't touched. The sound engineers at the radio station, the people working in the bookstore, the person on the bus who saw me looking at my own book as I was preparing to go to someplace, it's just everywhere, and it touches almost everyone. So we can do a lot for it, but we certainly haven't eliminated it or even really reduced it very much.
Yeah, and the shamefulness of it and the stigma is still very much with us, even though we are all touched by it.
It's amazing to me how much stigma there is, and I think that stigma is so dangerous because it so frequently prevents people from seeking and getting the help that they need. I had an experience which was very illuminating to me, a couple I know very slightly socially. We're at a party I was at a while ago, and the woman took me aside at this party and said, you know, I've been a little bit depressed recently, and I really don't want anyone to know, and please don't say anything to my husband. He just wouldn't understand it, but I've been taking such and such a medication, and I wanted to ask you some questions. And so we chatted about it, and I gave her some information. And about a month later, I got a telephone call from her husband, and he said to me, I haven't really talked about this with anyone, but you know, I've been having a depression, and I've actually been taking this medication, and I'm not sort of quite sure what it is. He said, I really don't want anyone to know, and my wife would think me less of a man if she knew about this. And he sort of went on in that vein. And they were taking the exact same medication and hiding it from each other. And I just thought it was so sad, the loneliness that comes out of people's perception of stigma. My experience is that there are definitely some contexts in which that perception is correct. I mean, according to a recent poll in which people were asked whether they would vote for a political candidate whom they supported in all ways but who had suffered from depression, 30% of people said no, if they knew the candidate had suffered from depression, that would be a reason for voting against him. So there are still people with strong objections. On the other hand, in many instances, within families, within workplaces, people find that when they do finally admit to having depression, they get a lot of support because so many of the other people around them will end up saying, oh, you do? Me too.
Hmm. Has depression always been a shameful illness?
No, actually it hasn't. I did a lot of historical research, and one of the things that fascinated me was to discover that in the ancient world, in the early Christian world, depression was no more shameful than a stomachache or any of a lot of other physical complaints. What happened was that in the Middle Ages, at the time of St. Augustine, all illnesses were classified as illnesses of the body or illnesses of the soul. And depression, as all mental illness, in fact, were classified as illnesses of the soul, and they were therefore seen as a mark of God's disfavor. And during the Spanish Inquisition, depression was seen as an indication that you had given up on the assurance of ultimate redemption, and therefore you were faulty in your belief, and you could be punished as somebody who was not a true believer for being depressed. And so at that point, people began to hide their depression, lest they be prosecuted by the church, and families began to hide people who were depressed, and that was where the stigma originated. It's also, of course, a time when a lot of the secrecy around sex and sexuality really kicked in, was in the medieval church. But our feelings about depression and our sense of the stigma around depression is really a relic of the medieval church, and that's why it seems particularly absurd that it should be so strong today.
Mm. I know that side effects are a big issue with medication, but I also wonder, is the stigma of depression at all responsible for the difficulty some people have staying on medicine, and two, for the view on the part of some that, well, as soon as you're fixed up and good as new, well, it's best to get off those pills?
Well, I think there are a number of factors leading to that. First off, I should say, I think that's a very dangerous attitude. If you have one episode of depression and you've taken medication and you've got better, then that's terrific, and it may well be that you've pulled through a rough time and now you're all right and you can see how you go without the medication. But if you've had two episodes, and certainly if you've had three episodes, what you have is recurrent depression. And people say, well, I don't want to be on medication for my whole life. I think that's really bad for you just to be on medication for your whole life. The indications so far are that being on medication for your whole life really isn't very bad for you. It doesn't seem to have any long-term toxic effects. What is definitely really bad for you is to keep having bouts of major depression. That ultimately causes the death of brain cells and carves pathways into your brain, and going on and off the medication all the time is like going on and off heart medication while you have one heart attack after the next. It ultimately really weakens the organ. So it's very important, if you really do have chronic recurring depression, that you stay on medication for the long term. I think people don't like to stay on medication partly from side effects, but I think a lot from a sense that really good, strong people should be able just not to keep getting depressed, and that there's some kind of weakness associated with taking medication, and people don't like images of themselves as weak. I think ultimately that it takes a lot more strength and courage to acknowledge exactly what's wrong with you and to have the discipline to take the medication when you need to and on the correct schedule. I think that the process of taking the medication is often an indication of great strength, and that there's a kind of foolish vanity a lot of the time in trying to go off it. Nonetheless, people certainly continue to do that, and I can say all of this in a very sage tone of voice right now. When I first started taking medication, I got better, and I immediately thought, I don't want to be on medication. It's just a gut instinct that I think is there in our society. I didn't like the idea of being on anything for a long time, and I went off medication, and I promptly had a breakdown, which I would not recommend to anyone.
Mm-hmm. Writer Andrew Solomon is our guest this afternoon on The Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, I invite your participation this afternoon. You can join the conversation with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, our number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. A listener is waiting to talk with us on the toll-free line in Taylorville on line 4. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. I freely admit that I suffer from depression, and I conclude my remarks, I've got two questions, one rather small and one considerably larger, and they're curiously enough interlinked. Incidentally, Inquisition was all over Europe. It wasn't just in Spain. I find, as a device that helps me sometimes, I can read dreadful stuff like Schopenhauer's On the Sufferings of the World, and I feel his sick glee coming through, and I can, it's a goofy idea, but sometimes I laugh at my own despair. I had episodes years and years ago where I was so depressed, I slept for a full day. Something dreadful happened in high school. Another event where I slept essentially for about 3 days straight, getting up. I was perhaps awake 6 hours in that period. Had to do with a romantic bit of business. And the hilarious thing is I thought it was over, and it wasn't over. It blossomed fully about a year and a half later. For example, I wanted to read this very brief paragraph from Schopenhauer, which somehow I don't know why, but it ties in with that quotation from Ovid that you read earlier. The pleasure in this world, it has been said, outweighs the pain, or at any rate, there is an even balance between the two. If the reader wishes to see shortly whether the statement is true, let him compare the respective feelings of two animals, one of which is engaged in eating the other. I recently thought of reading one of Styron's, William Styron's great books, again, The Lie Down in Darkness, which is really an insanely depressing book. I understand he suffered from it. I can handle that kind of stuff now, but I can't handle my own life very well, the house cleaning thing, for example. Now, my questions, you still there?
Mm-hmm.
You're there?
Yes.
Somebody changed the radio at the station. All right, I have a drinking problem I indulge in in a kind of obsessively periodic way, 5 or 7 days a month. And I find that it only heightens my depression. And, this business about having trouble getting out of bed, I just lie in bed and read one goofy piece of escape literature after another. Now, I find that part of my depression, I would say that I've intellectualized it in a way. For example, I tend toward misanthropy, and I look at the environment and the population things. I give the human race about another 2 centuries at the outside, and I no more believe in the human future than I believe that thing in the White House is a sentient entity. Unfortunately, sentient entity, or in the tooth fairy, and with this kind of despair, sort of intellectualizing. I really believe that's what I'm doing. I feel no strong inclination to kick my alcohol habit, and I'm like in a little room. I'm running circles. I'm exercising okay, but I'm not doing a thing with my life, not really.
Let's give Andrew Solomon an opportunity to respond to this caller.
Right. Well, there's a lot there to respond to. I would begin by saying that Schopenhauer also said that the polar opposite of suffering is boredom. So he was quite keen on the idea that suffering was ennobling in some way. I'm going to run, I think, with the part of your long statement that you said was a question, which is that you do tend to drink a lot, and that when you drink a lot, you tend to stay in bed a lot, and that seems to increase the level of your depression. And I'm going to give you a utilitarian answer. Whether the human race is likely to survive beyond the next 2 centuries is something that I find it difficult to predict very clearly right here, right now, though
though I'm somewhat more optimistic, I think, than you are. But I certainly think that if you are depressed and you take alcohol, which is a depressant, on a regular basis, that's going to exacerbate your depression and make it worse. And I think that when someone who has an alcohol problem and a depression problem comes along, that the depression makes people long for alcohol more much of the time because the alcohol blunts the negative emotion, which can be very unbearable, but the alcohol also makes the depression much more powerful and much stronger, and that if you want to get into something of an upward spiral rather than a downward spiral, it can be very useful to try to treat both the depression and the alcoholism and to try to reduce the amount of alcohol you take and to try to do whatever it may be, medications, therapy, any of the various things that are available to treat depression, and to try to do them at once. And I think what many people tend to find is that it's very difficult to begin the turnaround, but if you can get the depression to begin to lift, that the urge for drinking begins to lift, if you can get the drinking to begin to lift, that the depressive tendencies begin to lift. So I think that that's the very pragmatic answer to your question. The sort of large philosophical issues you've brought up are fascinating, but I think it would take the next 2.5 hours on this program to begin to delve into them, and so I'm not going to attempt that.
Hmm. Other questions, comments are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. There's a fascinating question that runs through the Noonday Demon, Andrew Solomon, and that is, what allows some people to hold on through so much? And you write at one point in the book, it was too difficult to remember and think and express and understand all the things I needed to do to be able to talk, to keep my face animated at the same time was insult added to injury. It was like trying to cook and roller skate and sing and type all at once. I imagine for you, talking and writing and thinking are so much a part of who you are. How were you able to hold on and cook and roller skate and sing and type all at once?
Well, it was one of the things that was really shocking about depression, and it's very hard to get across to people who haven't been through it, is that it's not just that you don't feel like doing anything. It starts off being a matter of not feeling like doing anything, and then as the depression escalates, you get to the point at which it really is acutely physically disabling, the point at which you really can't do anything. And when you get to that point at which you can't do anything, then you know that the depression is really spinning out of control. There was just a point at which I can remember thinking, it just took so much energy to get dressed. It felt to me as though getting dressed then took more time and effort than sort of 2 hours working out at the gym would take on a sort of more normal occasion. And there was a point at which I remember lying in bed and thinking, I should call someone and try to get some help. And the idea of picking up the phone and pushing those buttons and then talking into the telephone, I felt about it the way I would feel if someone told me that I was supposed to walk on foot from New York City to Chicago. I couldn't imagine how I could possibly do it. It just seemed like such an enormous thing. And I knew in the back of my mind that that was ridiculous. I thought, come on, you dial the phone all the time. People dial the phone all the time. It's an easy, straightforward business. And I kept trying to sort of get my rational mind and my irrational feelings somehow to go back into sync, but I just couldn't. There was just this sort of driving feeling of, I can't do it. I can't do this. It's a terrifying feeling. It's a terrifying feeling, and it's an overwhelming feeling. And you push yourself physically, and it's just as though your muscles have atrophied. It's as though the nerves that go to those muscles have atrophied. You just find yourself so profoundly disabled by it.
Let's talk with another listener on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Fine, thanks.
Well, I just have a little bit of a comment, really, just to other listeners out there who may, you know, be suffering from depression and have never done anything about it. Me personally, I suffered for probably 3 years before I got into some counseling, did a couple years of counseling, and finally got some medication. And surprisingly, my counselor at first, you know, resisted me being on medication. And I finally just went to a psychiatrist on my own, and that really made a huge difference for me, you know, the being on Prozac. And, but it's just trying to give some people encouragement out there that, you know, I mean, I think a combination of talk therapy and, in some cases, medication can make a big difference in a person's life. And, you know, I've gone on to do good things, you know, go to graduate school and, you know, do all sorts of things that I guarantee would not have happened had I not, you know, gotten myself straightened out. So that's really all I wanted to say. So thank you very much for your program.
Well, I think that it's, in the first place, I'd like to say that I think there's no question now, the evidence is very clearly in from a number of studies, that the combination of medication and talking therapy is much more effective than either one is alone, and that people who can manage to get a combination of the two are definitely doing the best thing possible. I think that the medication works quickly, but that you really need to understand what's going on and what changes have taken place in yourself and how to control and rethink your life so that you don't get into another episode, and try to understand what happened and how your sense of yourself has possibly been changed during an episode. So I think that's really excellent advice. I actually had the same experience as the caller we've just heard from. I was in psychoanalysis at the time that my first depression started. I had been through some traumatic experiences in my life. My mother, to whom I'd been very close, had died. I had ended a relationship with someone I'd been living with. I had ended up moving from England, where I had lived for some time, back to the United States, and my whole life was feeling very disrupted, and I had started seeing a psychotherapist for the first time, and when I was in that psychotherapeutic work, I became very, very depressed, and the analyst kept saying, well, I think it's very brave and courageous of you not to seek out medications and not to seek other kinds of help. And I really, in retrospect, feel I could probably have sued her for malpractice, because if I had gone on medication earlier, I could have avoided the sort of serious breakdown that I ultimately had. I think it's important to have people who are open-minded to the idea of putting together multiple forms of treatment, and people sort of say to me, well, do you think I should try this, or do you think I should try that, or maybe I should try this? And my usual advice is, try them all. Try everything, try it all at once, and then later on you can sort of fiddle around and see whether you want to stop doing something or stop doing something else or do a little more of something or a little less of something. But just do whatever you can to stave off the depression when it's really coming at you. The other thing I'd like to say in connection with that is that while most people who suffer from depression can find remission from that depression and can get better, only about half of people who suffer from depression will get better from the first thing that they try, even from the first medication that they try. So one of the things that's really important if you have depression is to know that you have to keep trying. You have to be willing to try a second or possibly a third medication. You have to be willing to try, if cognitive behavioral therapy doesn't help you, for instance, to try interpersonal therapy. You have to look through some kind of a handbook, and I'd like to think The Noonday Demon is one of them that could be useful, but you have to look through a book and see what the different things are that are out there and be willing to give one after the next a try, because ultimately you probably can get better. I met an awful lot of people while I was researching this book and since I've published it who said to me, well, I've been really depressed, but I've tried this and it just didn't work, and I guess I just have to learn to live with this. And almost nobody has to just learn to live with it. Almost everyone can get better if they've got the gumption to go out and figure out what to do.
Yeah, and there are stories in the book of people who have hung in and pulled through and continue to fight. Frank Resikoff comes to mind, and also a woman by the name of Angela. Terrific stories. Tell us about those two individuals.
Well, Frank's story is particularly compelling in this regard. He had the worst depression I've ever seen in my life. I remember when I first met him, he was so moving and so compelling to me. He was a really nice guy, and he was basically a really nice all-around kind of guy who'd done pretty well with, he'd done well in college, and he'd been on a couple of university athletic teams, and he was just a really all-around good guy, and he just had this terrible, crippling depression, which had set in when he was in his early 20s, and it was so disabling that he would reach the point at which he couldn't move. He was almost catatonic. He would be just weeping uncontrollably for hours on end. And he had tried all kinds of medications. He had tried electroshock therapy. The electroshock therapy was briefly helpful. He was, at the time I saw him, getting electroshock treatments once a month, which he really hated. Ultimately, he tried something which is done very rarely, but for people who have got that kind of very, very extreme case and for whom nothing else has been helpful, which is a kind of brain surgery called a cingulotomy, in which they actually drill a hole through the skull and they burn a very small lesion into the surface of the brain. And when he told me he was going to get it, I thought, well, gosh, that's really brave of you, and I hope it works, but it sounded awfully extreme to me, and I kind of thought, you've tried so many other things and none of them have worked, and I had only limited faith in it. But I thought, well, I'll be interested to know what happens. And he went and he had this surgery, which sounded so scary, and he's now fine. He's now completely fine. He was just up at a party that I had a couple of weeks ago, and he was doing really well, and he brought his girlfriend, who he seems incredibly happy with, and he's got a great job, and he wrote me a letter, which I happen to have here at Christmas, that I found really moving, describing what was going on at Christmas. He said, "My dad gave me two presents this year. First, a motorized CD rack from the Sharper Image. Totally unnecessary and extravagant, but Dad knew I'd get a kick out of it. I opened this huge box and saw something I didn't need at all and knew my dad was celebrating the fact that I'm living on my own, have a job I seem to love, and can pay my own bills. The other present was a photo of my grandmother who committed suicide. As I opened the present, I began to cry. My mother came over to the chair and asked if I was crying because of all the relatives I never knew, and I said, she had the same disease I have. I'm crying now. It's not that I'm so sad. I just get overwhelmed. Maybe it's that I could have killed myself but didn't because those around me convinced me to keep going. And I had the surgery. I'm alive and grateful to my parents and those doctors. We live in the right time, even if it doesn't always seem like it." Mm. It was amazing to see that transformation.
And let me say one thing about Angela, this other person in the book that I was so moved by. Her dream was to go on Oprah and give folks a message of hope and tell them, hang in there, don't hurt yourself, get help.
Absolutely, and I'd love to say a few words about her because I know she'd be really pleased to know that her story was being told out there. She's someone who had had all kinds of terrible traumas in her childhood. She'd been the victim of she was raped when she was a small child by the school janitor, and she'd had a number of other really significant early traumas, and she'd had very severe depression for a long time, and she'd been given to a lot of very severely self-destructive behavior. And what struck me as I spent a lot of time with her, she'd spent most of her adult life in mental hospitals, was that she was someone who had always been incredibly kind to all of the people around her. And I thought, the people who have been through this, some of them get hardened by it, and they get totally self-involved, and she was someone who was always reaching out to people. And when she said to me she wanted to be on a talk show, I thought, oh, I wonder if that's an ego issue or something she wants to do because she wants to mm-hmm. promote herself, and it wasn't at mm-hmm. all. She just said, I spent so much time hurting myself, and I finally understand that that's not a good thing to do. And she'd finally entered into the community, and she finally had a job herself, and she was on something like 14 medications. It had been a very complicated process figuring out what might help her. She said, I just want to tell people, don't hurt yourself, get help, stick with it, you'll be able to get to be okay, and just tell people to take care of themselves. It was a very touching, very moving time.
Yeah. And for those of us who have loved ones, family or friends who with depression, there's a big lesson in there for us as well, is to be kind, to be there, to listen, to stand
Absolutely.
By.
People often say to me, what should I do as a member of the family of someone who's depressed? And I always say, you know, depression is essentially an illness of aloneness. No matter how surrounded you are by people who love you, you feel perilously alone when you're severely depressed. And if you have people around you who can keep telling you over and over again that they love you and that they're there for you even though you've become depressed and even though you feel as though no one could possibly love you because you've become so unlovable. That's what makes the most difference. You need people to encourage you to. You don't need people to tell you to dance on a broken leg. You don't need people saying, come on, there's nothing that much wrong with you. Get up, go out, do things. That's just drives you crazy. But you do need people just sitting with you and just being there and just telling you day after day after day, patiently, you know I love you, you know I want you to be well, you know I'm here for you, you know I'll be here for you, you know whatever happens, I'm always here for you. It's just being present for people that makes so much difference and making people feel as though there's something safe around them that's holding them. They aren't going to just fall through and be alone, genuinely alone.
Let's talk with another listener on the toll-free line, line 4 in Bourbonnais. Good afternoon.
Hi. I'm calling to report something that works for me. From time to time, I get this feeling of depression, and it feels like it's inside of my skull, kind of forward, you know, maybe above my eyes. And I've learned that I can just, with an act of will, roll it back, like you might roll a roll-top desk back towards the back of my skull, and it works. The feeling goes away. It's gone.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, I think it's incredibly useful and incredibly important to exercise will. I think will can make a huge difference. I think most depression does not respond to will alone, but if you can manage with focus and concentration to do something, that's fantastic. And part of what cognitive behavioral therapy in particular is about, but also some kinds of meditation and so on that have been shown to be effective against depression, is about trying to focus mental energies in a way that allows you to exercise will to improve your mental state. There are people who are able, by concentrating on things that they find positive or believe to be positive, are able to get themselves into a state of mind in which they feel better and in which things begin to go better for them. But if you can do it just by thinking about it when the depression comes up in the space behind your eyes, gee, that's fantastic. If you figure out how it works so other people can do it, patent it and get out there with it.
In the final chapter, which is titled Hope, you say the opposite of depression is not happiness. What is the opposite of depression?
Vitality. I think that the essence of depression is not so much being unhappy, though unhappy is an important part of it. I think the essence of depression is that feeling that I was describing a few minutes ago of being just unable to do things and unable to cope and unable to get on with things. It's a very weighty, overwhelming, disabling, slowed-down feeling where you don't have any dynamism or energy or you don't have the capacity for joy. I don't think the opposite of depression is joy itself. I think the opposite of depression is the capacity for joy, the ability to be exhilarated, the state of mind in which you can actually be fantastically drawn into something, an awakeness to things, an awareness of things, an aliveness to all of the rich and plenty of the world, and a gameness to go out and find all of those things and experience them to their fullest.
Mm. A little bit like back to the woman in Cambodia, in Phnom Penh, who discovered what works for her and for women that she is working with there. It seems to me that it is having a whole life, a good life.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that having one of the things depression takes away from you is any sensation of having a whole or a good life. You feel when you're in depression as though what you have is such a poor excuse for a life that it has no value at all. And that's a very hollow, empty feeling, as though your life is damaged and useless and negative.